So let me begin by reminding you that gravity is the dominant force in the universe on astronomical scales, and that immediately leads to a surprising conclusion. All gravitationally bound structures in the universe are either spheres or disks. This is an empirical fact, and it's simply because gravity is the dominant force. Let's not go there. Spheres exist because gravity is basically balancing pressure, reverses pressure. And examples of these things are stars, planets, and elliptical galaxies, actually, where they're not always spheres, but that's simply because the pressure is anisotropic. You have an anisotropic pressure tensor. And you have disks where gravity is basically balanced by rotation. And examples of this are Saturn's rings, the protoplanetary disk that formed our own solar system, and spiral galaxies, which are also basically in a balance between gravity and rotation. Now, this isn't quite true. There are gravitationally bound structures which are neither spheres or disks. Giant molecular clouds in galaxies, as the astrophysicists here know, are much messier, and that's because they're actually supported by magnetic fields and turbulence. But apart from those, this is basically all there is. There are systems where pressure and rotation are just as important or equally important, but they tend to evolve into systems where, because of angular momentum transport, you end up with a central sphere surrounded by a disk which contains most of the angular momentum. So understanding how astrophysical disks work is incredibly important because they make up half the roughly half the bound structures in the universe in terms of what structures exist. Now, when I try and assemble these structures, if, for example, I start with a sphere and I accrete matter onto it, and I do this spherically symmetrically, and this has a mass m and a radius r sub n, this basically releases a gravitational power, which is the gravitational potential energy per unit mass times m dot, okay? However, when this accretion occurs, the gravitational force on the infalling matter, so gravity, is given by g m m over r squared, Newton's universal law of gravitation. But if this material is rotating and it has some angular momentum, and that angular momentum is conserved maybe because this accretion process is axisymmetric, then I have a centrifugal force acting on that material, which is, of course, m v phi squared over r. And if I express that in terms of the specific angular momentum, the angular momentum per unit mass, this is m l squared over r cubed. And you'll notice that this is proportional to 1 over r squared, and this is proportional to 1 over r cubed. So material that is rotating and falling in under its own gravity or onto a gravitating object will eventually become centrifugally supported and form a rotating structure, at least if a circularization radius, so r circ, which is of order l squared over gm, if that exceeds the size of the object on which you're accreting, you'll end up with a disk around this object. So material falls in like this. This is the circularization radius, and you end up with a rotating disk inside there. Okay, so that's how we think disks form. In fact, this is an example of what we think is going on in galactic nuclei, where this is a supermassive black hole, SMBH. I'm going to be throwing out acronyms a lot because astrophysics is full of such acronyms, so please interrupt me if you don't understand what I'm talking about. This could also be a protostar, in which case this is a disk in which planets might be forming, accreting from a molecular cloud in our own galaxy.
So you're saying that's the view of our galaxy?
That's the view of the central, the innermost regions of galaxies. Active galaxies and quasars. This is sort of how we think. I can get into that. Actually, I now think that this radius is, the circularization radius is frighteningly close into the black hole. There's observational evidence for that, but I'm not going to talk about that here. Another way that disks form, in which you get structures which are supported against gravity by rotation, is in binary systems. So I have a compact object, say a white dwarf, a neutron star, or a black hole, or even an ordinary star, and it's in orbit around another star, which, say, is ascending the red giant branch and swelling up to overfill its Roche lobe and material starts to fall through the inner Lagrange point. Viewed in the rotating frame, so the angular velocity vector is pointing out of the blackboard, the velocity of this material is this way. Okay, there's a Coriolis force acting on this material, minus 2 omega cross V. Omega's out of the board, V is this way, minus gives you a Coriolis force in that direction. And that causes the material to circle around like that. Okay, in the same direction that the, omega's like this, excuse me. So omega's out of the blackboard. So the material is ending up in a disk around the primary object. Okay, and that's also a way that accretion disks are thought to form. Okay. Now, just as stars or spherical objects can contract under their own gravity if they lose this pressure support, an accretion disk, which is supported against gravity by rotation, can also sort of contract if it loses angular momentum, if it loses that rotational support. And that's what we call an accretion disk. So I have this disk around some central object, okay, and angular momentum flowing outwards by some mechanism, and that's going to be the dominant part of what I'm going to tell you about, causes mass to slowly flow inward, okay? Now, the virial theorem for circular orbits here states that twice the kinetic energy plus the potential energy is equal to zero. And so the total energy of any orbit, which is the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, is simply half the potential energy. Or for Kepler orbits, that's minus gm m over r twice. So this inward flow of material causes a power release, which is gm m dot over twice times the inner radius at which you're actually accreting onto the object. That's only half the power output that comes from spherical accretion. The other half actually comes out if there's a surface to this object, and then there's a boundary layer here, and so you get a full extra one-half of the overall accretion power here. I'm not going to talk about this at all, and indeed the entire Jets and Disks program is completely ignoring this part of the physics. And in fact, most of us are concentrating on black holes which have no surfaces precisely because we don't want to deal with that. Okay, the boundary layer physics is actually incredibly complicated. I'm not going to be talking about this at all, but it's very important, of course, in accreting systems onto white dwarfs or neutron stars, because fully half the luminosity comes out that way. The disk luminosity is concentrated towards the innermost regions because, of course, that's where the most of the mechanical energy is. Now, this J dot, if you transport angular momentum outwards, because material is becoming increasingly bound, you also actually have to transport energy outwards, okay? And this is done both mechanically through whatever torque is exerting this angular momentum transport. You also release energy through radiation, which is how we observe these things often. And there's also the possibility of outflows extracting energy. Those outflows can extract angular momentum, and in fact, they can extract mass too. And that's also something that's going to be a theme here. So there's angular momentum transport through the disk, and there's the possibility of angular momentum extraction in outflows. And that's why this program is jets and disks, because disks may be intimately related to outflows and jets. Okay. Now, everything that's interesting about accretion disks flows from this, from how energy and angular momentum are extracted or transported through the disk. That's where all the physics lies. And for a long time, this field is now about 32, 33 years old. People have assumed, or often assumed, that this transport occurs through turbulence that exists in the disk. You can show that microscopic or molecular viscosities in this shear flow are incredibly unimportant for explaining the observed timescales that we see in these systems. And so people have often thought that this accretion disk is turbulent, and we just model this anomalous stress, which is exerting torques inside the disk, as being some fudge factor times the average pressure in the disk, where this is the gas pressure. And this is a fudge factor, which is a universal constant of nature related to the fundamental constants of physics. It's literally that bad. And this is because everything that's interesting about accretion disks flows from that. And because we've been using this fudge factor all this time, most of what we've been doing is complete garbage, okay? We've been fundamentally limited by understanding what is really going on there. The fudge factor is modeled. It's what? It's one of our alpha. No, it's alpha. It's roughly alpha, the fine structure constant. Okay. Let me. That fudge actually has explained some things about what we observe, and let me just mention some of these things. Well, maybe I should mention where accretion disks are found, first of all. Yeah, let me do that first. So here's a whole series of acronyms where accretion disk physics is incredibly important. YSOs, young stellar objects. These are protostars surrounded by disks where planets are thought to form. The ITP just held a program about a year ago on planet formation in disks. I'm not going to be talking about these systems too much. CVs, those are called cataclysmic variables. Those are systems which contain white dwarfs with a disk around them, and the disk undergoes an accretion instability, which causes these systems to flare. And I'll talk about the physics of that in just a second. There are things called NSXRBs, which are neutron star X-ray binaries. These are systems which contain neutron stars at the center of the disk. And of course, there are BHXRBs, which are black hole X-ray binaries. There are things called ULXs, possibly, which are ultra-luminous X-ray sources. These are X-ray sources that we see in external galaxies, which we think might be, in some cases, certainly one or two, the accretion onto intermediate mass black holes with masses of 1,000 solar masses or so, although that's still a little controversial. There's something called Sag-A star, which is the black hole sitting at the center of our own galaxy, which is also accreting material from its surroundings. The material originates from stellar winds, from stars that are in orbit around that black hole. Presumably other galactic nuclei contain black holes which are accreting at very, very low luminosities. And there are much more luminous cousins, active galactic nuclei and quasars. And while I'm here, let me also mention GRBs, which are gamma ray bursts. These are the most powerful explosions that we know of in the universe. And these are, at least for the so-called long-duration gamma ray bursts, they're almost certainly due to the formation, the collapse of a rotating stellar core to a black hole, which forms a black hole in a disk. Now, among all of these sources are observed to have outflows associated with them. And some of them, these, and certainly these, are observed to contain very well collimated jets as well. And the origin of those jets is still a bit of a mystery, as I'll describe in a second. Several million solar masses, yeah. And that's actually known to, what, two significant figures now or something, reliably? 3.5. Because we actually see orbits, I mean real elliptical orbits, from the stars around them, where we can measure in some cases, we know all the orbital parameters for at least one of those stars.
What do you have in mind for a well-collimated jet for Sag-A star?
Chandra image, it's Mitch Beagleman's, Baganoff's thing, where there's this little linear structure. Okay. There's evidence for that. Yeah, I admit that that's a little... Yeah, the astrophysicists aren't supposed to ask questions here. Okay, let me tell you what's actually understood from this ancient theory of accretion disks using this sort of fudge here. The first thing that's well explained is, at least in those disks which are optically thick and radiate mostly like black bodies, the characteristic photon energies are related to a characteristic temperature, which is of course given by the luminosity divided by the Stefan-Boltzmann constant times some area squared to the 1/4, or of order gm m dot over sigma r n cubed to the 1/4. Okay, if you just calculate for various masses and expected accretion rates in these systems, you find out the cataclysmic variables should be radiating mostly in the optical and ultraviolet, as do AGN and quasars. That all makes sense. Systems which contain neutron stars and stellar mass black holes should be radiating mostly in the X-rays. That all makes sense. YSO should be radiating in the infrared. Everything, all of this sort of makes sense. So that's a, you know, a very rough prediction. The other big success of ancient accretion disk theory is explaining the variability that we see in cataclysmic variables, and also, let's introduce another acronym, soft X-ray transients, which are black hole X-ray binaries and neutron star X-ray binaries which undergo flares. Both of these flaring type behaviors are due to a thermal instability in the disk, which is associated with the ionization of hydrogen. So if I go to a particular radius of the disk and I measure its surface density and the accretion rate that's going through there, and actually I calculate a thermal equilibrium structure for that particular annulus and plot m dot versus the surface density in the present in the regime where hydrogen is ionizing, so it's going from neutral to ionizing, the structure that I get out looks something like this, the possible equilibrium structures. And if I have if I feed this disk with an external accretion rate m dot, which is here, what happens is that I end up with a limit cycle behavior where the material, where the disk is constantly jumping between these low m dot states, low luminosity states, and high luminosity states. Okay, and that's just because of the existence of this S-curve topology. So it's a simple limit cycle, and this explains what we observe in these systems. What's interesting from the point of view of a more fundamental theory is that the accretion stress, this tau r phi, is known to be higher in this high luminosity state than it is down here. Okay, so it's not just the fine structure constant. There is some variability in the accretion stress, and we can measure that directly from these observations. But there are lots of things that we don't understand about accretion systems, accretion disks. And let me just illustrate these, well, mainly focusing on sources which contain black holes. So problems. Number one is we don't understand the origin of jets. Okay. Those of you who were here for the other talk from the Jets and Disks program by Hank Sprout witnessed a model based on what's called a magnetocentrifugal mechanism, where I have a central object, I have an accretion disk which is rotating around. This accretion disk has a poloidal field anchored to the disk, okay, which is rotating around with the disk. Above a critical surface, which we call the Alfvén surface, the kinetic energy of material loaded onto these field lines becomes larger than the magnetic energy density, and that focuses that forces these field lines to curl around in a helix above this disk, and that's what launches and collimates. It both accelerates and collimates this jet. That's a very nice picture, but where does it come from? Where do these poloidal field lines come from? Is that a realistic picture given what I'm going to be talking about in terms of what's going on inside the disk here? Coronae. Most of these objects, in addition to showing a thermal spectrum which peaks roughly with photon energies in that range, also exhibit a harder spectrum, a hard X-ray spectrum. And I'm going to illustrate this actually with black hole X-ray binaries, and this will get us more into the details of what of the difficulties that we're facing. So black hole X-ray binaries, systems which contain a stellar mass black hole and orbit around usually a low mass star, but sometimes a high mass star, actually exist in three states. And I'm going to plot their spectra, nu f nu versus nu, in these three states. Okay. So the low luminosity state basically looks like a power law with possibly a cutoff. So this is the low hard state. This spectrum looks nothing like a black body. Okay. There's something called the high soft state, which is dominated by a black body like component, which then comes down here and has this tail going up to hard X-rays. And then there's a state which sort of looks like a merger between the two, called the very high state, or the steep power law state. Now, the reason I'm harping onto this is I want to show you what we think is going on with the accretion flow in these three different states. And that will illustrate some of the problems that we're facing. In this low hard state, what we think is going on is you don't even have an optically thick accretion disk at all, except perhaps at very large radii. Instead, you have a very hot, geometrically thick flow, which possibly merges onto a geometrically thin disk. And also, always in the state, you have a jet. That's always in the low hard state. Okay, this hot flow is either comptonizing soft photons from the disk or from another place and producing these hard X-rays, or these hard X-rays are perhaps being produced at the base of the jet. We don't know. There are models that look at both of those possibilities. The high soft state is easy. That's a disk, a standard geometrically thin disk, which is black body-like everywhere. It produces this nice thermal spectrum. And yeah, there's this tail on it because maybe there's some magnetic flares going on above the disk, which also Compton scatters some soft photons. And then this state, well, it's more of this, except now this corona, imagine the surface of the sun where there are all these magnetic flaring activity is going on, is very powerful, okay? So this is actually radiating a lot of coronal emission. And there's also a variable jet here, often seen. So we've got to explain all this, okay? Why disks happen to go between these different states. It's not just the accretion rate going through the system. There appears to be some hysteresis in the system, which causes the flow to go through these three structures. Now, you'll notice that magnetic fields are likely to be important here, okay? Finally, let me mention variability. Okay, we can sort of explain the flaring activity that we see in cataclysmic variables and soft X-ray transients. What we have not been able to explain yet is that in the low hard state, there are quasi-periodic oscillations, oscillations with Qs which are of order a few to 10, which we don't really understand, but they appear to be maybe related to the Kepler frequency at the boundary between this thin disk and this hot, geometrically thick flow. So there are QPOs, both low frequency, which we think we sort of understand, although not really, and high frequency QPOs. These low frequency ones, their frequency actually varies in the way that you might expect as this disk moves in and out between these different states. The high frequency QPOs, you don't see them here, you don't see them here, you only see them here. And they have very fixed frequencies that are related uniquely to the source. And those frequencies are comparable to the orbital frequency of the innermost stable circular orbit of the black hole. Yes?
So those three options, do you see them in the same object?
Yes. There are objects which cycle through all three of these states. When you... Oh, no. In AGN. No, in AGN you don't see this, but there are analogs to all three of these states in active galactic nuclei as well, except that the time scales are longer than human lifetime, so you don't see transitions between these states. But these are Seyfert 1s, these are bright quasars, these are called narrow line Seyfert 1s. We think, maybe, okay? So yeah, by extension to AGN, this is also important. The high frequency QPOs are fascinating because they're at dynamical frequencies associated with the black hole, and they are fixed. If only we could understand them, they're probably telling us something about the black hole space-time, but we don't understand them. We really don't know what's causing them. But boy, would we like to. And then speaking of variability, I have to show you this. So there's broadband power as well in the X-ray light curves. But if you just look at the X-ray light curves for some of these sources, in particular one, this is one source, GRS 1915 plus 105. This is the X-ray light curve in its various accretion states, okay? Nature is screaming at us here that there is ordered variability here, and we have not got a clue, not a clue, as to what this is causing this. Not at all. And I'm totally serious. We are completely baffled by this. But this is such a huge clue. I mean, if you could just understand this, you're obviously going to learn a lot about what's going on in these flows. But we don't understand it, not at all. Okay, and I just thought I'd put it up there because astrophysics contains real data, which is really driving us to the craziness. Sorry? The timescales there, well, these are thousands of seconds. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 seconds. But you see variability on short time scales superposed on that long time scale variability. It's clearly, there is some order in this chaos, and we do not understand it at all. Okay, so those are some of the observational problems that we're facing. Okay, let me go back now. Now let me tell you about theory and the truth. And now that Steve has arrived, I can really say truth in capital letters. So I said that everything that's interesting about accretionists flows from how angular momentum is transported outwards. Okay. And the most popular model when you're actually trying to build theories to compare with observations is to assume some sort of turbulence in the disk, which is mocked up by this alpha, this universal constant times pressure. Now, accretion disks have very, very low molecular viscosities, okay? So they're very, very high Reynolds number flows. And so this doesn't seem crazy at first to a hydrodynamicist, that you have a shear flow, which just because of the existence of that shear, the innermost regions are rotating faster than the outermost regions, that's just Kepler's third law, there's free energy in that shear which can be tapped by an instability. And so it's not crazy to suppose that there's hydrodynamic turbulence going on. It's a high Reynolds number shear flow. Nobody, well, except very recently, nobody has succeeded in proving that such turbulence exists in disks. And in fact, this has been a source of incredibly acrimonious debate, as at least one member of the audience here can attest to, as to whether or not hydrodynamic turbulence exists. Believe it or not, just in this past year, there has been a consensus, I claim, that's been reached, even from the opponents of MHD turbulence. And there is maybe hydrodynamic turbulence that exists in disks, but the stress that you can get out of this hydrodynamic turbulence is completely, hopelessly too small to explain anything that we observe in nature. Okay, so that turbulence might exist, but forget it. It's just completely irrelevant for anything that's interesting in accretion disks and astrophysics. Okay, but there is free energy there, if only you could tap it. And you can tap it if the disk is ionized and conducting and contains a magnetic field. And that is the big breakthrough that was done about 14 years ago now by Steve Balbus and John Hawley. And that was that was showing that if you put in a weak magnetic field into the shear flow and the flow is conducting, that you get another acronym, but this is the acronym that you all have to take away from this talk. You get what's called a magnetorotational instability. And I'm going to explain the physics of this using a very simple mechanical analogy, which is very easy to understand. So I want you to imagine that I have a central mass and I have a particle which is in orbit around the central mass. And actually, let's make it two particles. And these two particles are sitting on top of each other, and they're connected by a spring which has zero equilibrium length. Okay, so this is at radius r, and this is going around at some angular velocity omega, the Kepler angular velocity. Okay, so I imagine these two particles connected together by a spring of zero equilibrium length. This is just a simple coupled oscillator problem, and let's just calculate the normal modes of this coupled oscillator. What have I done with my notes there? Because I'm not going to go through the calculation on the blackboard and embarrass myself. there are two types, just go back to your basic physics. If you imagine two masses on a pendulum connected by springs, there are two types of normal mode oscillations. One where they're swinging back and forth together and the spring does nothing, and one where the masses are oscillating back and forth opposite to each other and stretching and compressing the spring. Okay, those are the two types of normal modes. And you can do the same thing here. There are basically these two classes of normal modes here if you go through the analysis. This type of normal mode where I'm basically moving the masses together gives rise to, if I assume an e to the minus I omega t time dependence, an angular frequency squared, which is given by 4 omega squared plus r d omega squared by dr, where omega is the Kepler angular velocity, okay, given by Kepler's third law. This is famously called the epicyclic frequency in astrophysics. It's the frequency at which any body, if you perturb it around a circular orbit, will oscillate in the effective potential given by both gravity and angular momentum in the system. It's positive. In fact, for Kepler orbits, this happens to equal the angular velocity squared because of the Coulomb degeneracy. The 1/r potential. And it's the reason why the Earth is not careening into the Sun, of course. It's the reason why the Earth's orbit is stable, okay? The Earth is effectively oscillating around a circular orbit at the epicyclic frequency, which is equal to the angular velocity, which is why elliptical orbits are closed, which is why I'm mentioning the Coulomb degeneracy. Okay, so this is boring, okay, moving the masses together. This is just a one-particle perturbation. This is the more interesting case. If I write down the normal mode frequency in that case, it's given by this equation here. Okay, where k is the spring constant of the spring and mass, the mass is one of the, is the particle mass. I'm assuming equal mass particles here. Okay, and you'll notice that if I take the spring to zero, the spring constant goes to zero, I just get back to omega squared is equal to kappa squared, the epicyclic frequency. Now, this term, this factor here is negative, okay? Remember this is x squared plus bx plus c equals zero, okay? This term is negative. If I solve this quadratic equation for omega squared, I get a negative value of omega squared, implying a damped, unstable pair of modes if the C term is negative. So if 2k over m plus r d omega squared by dr is less than zero, I have an instability. Now this is mind-blowing, because of the following fact. Kepler's third law implies that the angular velocity is decreasing outwards. The orbital period of Mercury is shorter than the orbital period of the Earth. Okay, so this is automatically negative. This is a positive term. Adding the spring is, if you like, stabilizing, of course. If I have a big spring constant, it's going to cause those particles to snap back. Okay, but if the spring is weak, so this term is less than this term, I have an instability. So without the spring, the system is stable. A strong spring is also stable, but adding a spring that's arbitrarily weak destabilizes the system. Okay, that's what's paradoxical about this. Making the spring weak, weaker and weaker and weaker, just makes it more and more likely to be unstable. In fact, if the spring, this is of course just the natural frequency of oscillation of the spring, if omega naught, which is root 2k over m, is less than of order omega, then I will have instability. Now physically, why is that? Yes. Yes. Oh yeah, sure.
When
we have the people here. Oh, I think, okay, you should correct me. I thought Jeremy was the origin of this, but then everyone cites you, and I don't know who actually originated this. Was it Toomer?
Yeah, I think what happened was Allard Toomery had been, you know, loves to do these shearing boxes.
Yeah.
He was trying to put pressure in.
Uh-huh.
And so he put pressure in the form of a weak spring, you see, because that's the way pressure should work. And he never could quite get it to work. It was always misbehaving.
Yes.
So when the MRI came along, he wondered whether that might be related. But I think the first people to sit down, you know, and actually work it through and show in detail that is what happened was, you know, was John Hawley and I.
Okay.
We were certainly inspired by Allard's intuition on it.
I see. Okay. Okay. It's not actually written up in detail anywhere, I think.
Sure it is.
In the Ordate paper. I see. Okay. That's where it is. Okay. Okay.
But it was on the ground.
Yeah, it could have been, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Now, let me point out, okay, physically, first of all, what's going on here? So imagine I have this mass, and I move the two masses apart, and they're connected by the spring, okay? And I do this radially, so they basically conserve their angular momentum, okay, or at least at first. Now, because they've conserved their angular momentum, this mass, the skater's pulled in her arms, is moving faster, so this moves forward. This mass is moving, because the skater is pushed out her arms, is moving more slowly. So this quickly evolves to a system like this, okay, with a spring tethering between them. Now, this spring is now torquing on this mass and torquing on this mass. It extracts angular momentum from this mass and adds angular momentum to this mass. As this mass loses angular momentum, it will have a tendency to fall in further. As this mass gains angular momentum, it will have a tendency to fly out further. And that's what drives the instability. Now, there's a competing effect. If magnetic tension is too large, it will snap the two masses back together. And the order magnitude estimate is simply, if the natural frequency of oscillation of the spring is less than the orbital period, then this magnetic tension does not have time to act before the spring is wrapped around on itself and the torque effect is dominant, and that's what causes the instability.
You don't yet need to be invoking magnetic tension?
I don't yet need to be invoking?
Well, so far, it's too much spring.
Yeah, right. But you know that this is an exact analogy, right? So let me do the magnetic case. You know that.
No, I know that.
You need normal tension and magnetic tension.
Right. You need to make
the
Yeah, I know. I haven't talked about magnetic fields yet. Give me a break. Yes, I know. The astrophysicist, this is all Genesis in the Bible for the astrophysicist, okay? I mean, it's very basic stuff. Forgive me for going through this, but this is central to, as you all know, to what we're talking about here. So there is an exact, I mean, literally exact MHD analogy. And let me draw it for you. Imagine that I am material, again, orbiting now around this rotation axis. And I imagine two tori, of which these are cross-sections, threaded by a vertical magnetic field, okay, which is arbitrarily weak. And I perturb this torus in, and I perturb this torus out. In doing that, I get a system like this. Okay, so there's magnetic tension now. Bent magnetic fields exert tension. They want to straighten out. And if this tension is too large, these tori will want to snap back together again. But if the tension is weak enough, there's another effect here. Because this torus is now moving faster in angular velocity, it's going into the board faster than this. So this field line is actually not in the blackboard, but there's a toroidal component that's actually pointing into the blackboard here. Okay? That toroidal component will torque down this inner torus, torque up this outer torus, exchange angular momentum between the two, and cause the things to fly apart. Okay? So it's really exactly the same thing. And in fact, you can write down the dispersion relation for these MHD waves, and it's exactly this, where 2k over m, the square of the natural frequency of oscillation, is simply replaced by, now not the spring constant, but the wave vector, 2 pi over lambda, times the Alphane speed of this magnetic field, where that's k times b over root 4 pi rho. You get exactly the same dispersion relation. Okay, so the spring really is this magnetic field. Now it's a matter of magnetic field strength. If the field is too strong, the tension will be too large. You will stabilize the system. But you have an extra degree of freedom here. You also have the wavelength here, which is, of course, 2 pi over k. Okay. And if the wavelength is long, that will lessen the effects of magnetic tension, and so you will also drive an instability. Okay? So in fact, you can plot the growth rate of this instability. Growth rate. Right. And in fact, let me scale with the angular velocity against wave number scaled with the times the Alphane speed divided by the angular velocity. And it generically looks something like this, where this happens to be root 3 for Kepler orbits. It peaks out to nearly 1. It's approximately equal to 1. And this peaks at 3/4 times the angular velocity. Weak magnetic fields can destabilize the system with a growth rate that's aboard of the orbital frequency extremely fast. Okay. And the typical scale here of this instability is always happening at VA over omega. Okay, so the typical unstable wavelength is order VA over omega. So of course, for weak magnetic fields, this characteristic unstable wavelength is shorter and shorter and shorter. And in fact, if you include resistivity in the system, this curve turns out to be something like this. You reduce the growth rate, and you push the unstable wavelengths to be longer and longer and longer because you want to reduce the effects of magnetic tension, and you want to overcome the effects of resistivity. So if you make the system increasingly resistive, it becomes hydrodynamic, which is why hydrodynamic turbulences or hydrodynamic shear flows are linearly stable. But MHD shear flows are linearly unstable. Okay. This is the huge breakthrough that happened in accretionist theory now about 13 years ago. And it's, you know, it really is like, and this is said by many people, it's like the period in the first half of the 20th century when it was finally realized that stars shine because of nuclear fusion reactions, or stars shine for as long as they do because of nuclear fusion reactions that go on inside their cores. Okay, you now know the fundamental energy release mechanism inside these disks, which make up a lot of the systems that we see in the universe. And by understanding how this magnetorotational instability works, you can now start building, doing real theory of these disks and addressing some of these questions from a fundamental level rather than just invoking some completely ad hoc fudge factor which has no basis in physics whatsoever. So this instability has been simulated to death, but not exhaustively, okay, which makes no sense. And there's a lot more work that needs to be done, I'm afraid, as you're going to see. $64,000 question. Big question. Big question that's been debated back and forth in the program. I'll get to that later on. When you do computer simulations of the nonlinear development of this instability, you generically end up with 3D magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. Okay? And this stress that's responsible for angular momentum transport is actually given by a sum of the time and space averaged Reynolds stress and Maxwell stress associated with the magnetic field and velocity fluctuations. Okay, and this actually turns out to be always of order 1/2 times b squared over 8 pi, interestingly enough. So the stress, of course, scales with the magnetic energy density, not with the overall gas pressure. If only you knew what this magnetic energy density was, which you don't from first principles. This is true, but we don't know how to figure out what this is yet. This generally dominates over this by factors of 3 to 4, if you care about that. So many people have done these simulations in a variety of contexts and tried to understand the properties of this turbulence. And let me just mention 4 different contexts in which you get really interesting and different sorts of results to give you some flavor for what the JETSON-DISC program is trying to accomplish in addressing these various observed systems. The first case, which is not the first case that was looked at, but is the case of collisionless plasmas. These are particularly relevant to the galactic center, Sag A star, and also probably other low luminosity galactic nuclei. The densities are so small that the mean free paths are very, very large, and the plasma is essentially collisionless. In that case, it's sort of interesting. The MRI, you have to model it with a kinetic plasma approach, not with a fluid approach. Okay, forgive me, Elliot, for saying this sort of. It's sort of like MHD with an anisotropic pressure. P parallel, the pressure along the magnetic field, is not equal to the perpendicular component of the pressure. It's with an anisotropic pressure tensor. It's sort of like that. What's interesting is when the MRI develops, its growth rate, it depends on the magnitude of this pressure anisotropy. If the pressure anisotropy is too great, the MRI is suppressed. Okay. It turns out that when you do grow the MRI, it amplifies this pressure anisotropy. And so it kills itself, okay? Because it grows this pressure anisotropy until it can't sustain itself any longer and it just dies. Now, it turns out that if these pressure anisotropies are too big, there's a host of kinetic instabilities which limits how big this pressure anisotropy can get. So the MRI grows, it exacerbates this pressure anisotropy, but then these kinetic instabilities might kick in and limit how much anisotropy you get, and that keeps the MRI growing and sustaining itself. The end result is that you have Maxwell stress, and you also have a real viscous stress from the anisotropic pressure tensor, and that enhances angular momentum transport. And so people are trying to do simulations of the kinetics of this plasma to see whether that really works and how it works. Is that fair? This guy in particular has been devoting a lot of work to this effort. Protostellar disks. It shouldn't surprise you that disks which form planets are probably not highly conducting plasmas. They're made of rocks. among other things. And so if you want to think about how angular momentum works in protostellar disks, you have to take into account effects of finite resistivity, ohmic resistivity. You have to take into account the collisions between neutrals and ions, which gives rise to something called ambipolar diffusion. And you also have to take into account something called the Hall term in the generalized Ohm's law, which basically drives the plasma towards the magnetic field being frozen into the electrons rather than in the plasma as a whole. And you have to analyze how all of these effects work in driving the MRI in these weakly ionized systems. And there's debate on this. There are regions in the disk which appear to be totally dead as far as MHD turbulence goes, but then there are arguments that if you could launch the MRI, it would give rise to a sufficient ionization to keep itself going, and there's been a lot of work on that here in the program, too. The third case, which is the case close to my heart, is radiation pressure-dominated disks, where the radiation pressure, which is a third, AT to the fourth, is very much greater than the gas pressure. This case is relevant for quasars, for luminous black hole X-ray binaries, systems which contain black holes where there are lots of photons. Because you now have two pressures in the system, because photons diffuse through this plasma, it turns out that the MRI, which I forgot to mention this, it's essentially an incompressible instability. The magnetic energy densities that you develop are typically less than the gas pressure, so the turbulent motions are subsonic. But in this case, the turbulent motions can actually be supersonic with respect to the gas pressure and subsonic with respect to the radiation pressure. And in fact, if you build a disk model, you can show that the diffusion time of photons across an MRI wavelength is of order the orbital frequency. So it's of order the orbital period. So it's of order the MRI growth time. And so necessarily, radiative diffusion is killing the radiation pressure support, which is forcing the plasma to be incompressible. And so necessarily, the turbulence in this regime is compressible and gives rise to large density inhomogeneities in the plasma. So there are huge fluctuations in density, and that affects the way photons are thermalized with the plasma. It affects the way photons escape from the plasma. It gives rise, both with the MRI and another instability called the photon bubble instability, to the possibility of locally super-Eddington luminosities, where radiation pressure is bigger than gravity, but you don't necessarily drive an outflow. Lots of interesting stuff which may affect the spectra that we observe and the sorts of fluxes that you can get out of these flows. And a fourth case that I just want to mention briefly is the case of CVs, where we have a lot of data. These are the systems which gave us some idea of what the magnitude of the stresses were at first. Let me just say that when I mentioned that there was in the outburst state, the accretion stress is larger than in the quiescent state, that may be due to the fact that in the outburst state, the plasma is ionized, whereas in the quiescent state, the plasma is neutral. And so the MRI, because it cares about resistivity, may give rise to a higher accretion stress in the outburst state, and that has been suggested. So we're beginning to get a handle on what might be going on. These are questions that we couldn't even ask before. We are now able to ask these questions about how accretion disks might be very, very different in these different regimes and start addressing, building models that are based on real physics to try and compare with observations. Okay, unfortunately though, we're talking about turbulence, and that requires computer simulations to really get at some of this physics. And so I now want to just finish off by going through the three classes of computer simulations which have been done so far to show you some of what we've learned. And then I'll finish up with just posing some of the questions like you've asked, Jim. The first types of simulations which were done and are still being done and still need to be done are called local shearing box simulations. Basically, you have your disk, okay, and you zoom in on a tiny little portion of the disk, teensy weensy weensy, you pull it out, okay, there's this cube here which you're now simulating, okay, and you assume that the vertical boundary conditions are periodic, the azimuthal boundary conditions are periodic, and the radial boundary conditions are shearing periodic. You take into account that there's a background shear flow, and so when you map the inner radius to the outer radial boundary, you have to take into account that those two boundaries are shearing with respect to each other. And that's actually where the source of free energy for this turbulence is coming from, that shear flow. When you doing these simulations, of course, gives you the highest resolution, okay, because you're zooming into a tiny portion of the box, and you're able to address questions like what the turbulent power spectrum looks like, what the dissipative structures might look like on small scales. But unfortunately, they don't go nearly far enough. We just don't have the dynamic range available to us. Let me pose one question, which is interesting, people. If you plot the power spectrum of the turbulence as a function of k, you get things that look something like this, where this is k parallel to the magnetic field, and this is k perp to the magnetic field. And I've intentionally drawn the slopes here at high wave number to be different. Because people, there's this dogma that's been generated by some people that on scales much, much larger where rotation is no longer relevant, so k, so this is of order Va over omega, when you've got a high scales, the rotation should no longer be important and you should transition to ordinary MHD turbulence, which has been suggested to be consisting of a collisions of Alfvén waves which drive more and more of the power to higher and higher perpendicular wave numbers. This is called Goldreich-Schrödinger turbulence, and it's the basis for some of the thinking of how dissipation actually occurs on small scales. This has not yet been demonstrated in simulations. Okay, so there's a lot more work that needs to be done here, just in trying to understand these power spectra.
Sure, machine simulations.
Right, but then you're not driving it in the same. Right. Yes. This is one of the originators of the dogma, by the way. Not that it's an implausible dogma, but it's... Seriously, not that it's an implausible dogma. It's a very plausible dogma, but dogma nevertheless. They're stratified shearing boxes. What you do now is you take the disk, and you actually take a whole slice through the disk, okay? So you now have some vertical structure to the disk, to the simulation. Okay, so if this is the disk midplane, in particular, there's a tidal gravitational field that is acting toward the midplane, above and below the midplane. Okay, and this enables the main piece of physics this adds is the possibility of magnetic buoyancy. So as the magnetic field is built up by this magnetic rotational instability, it actually can float up. Okay. And one of the interesting things that has come out of these simulations, by the way, I should mention, these simulations are the only ones that include photon cooling as well. We've now progressed to a stage where we can do that. And when you do these simulations, and I plot the pressure as a function of height divided by some characteristic, this scale height, the gas pressure basically looks something like this. And this is a log plot, by the way. That's important. And the magnetic stress is under the gas pressure here. It builds up towards the surface layers and then is dominant in the uppermost layers. Okay, and this is typically at three gas pressure scale heights. This might be our corona that we've been looking for, a magnetically dominant corona that's sitting above and below the disk, and might explain this ubiquitous hard X-rays that we see in these accretion disks. Okay. These sorts of simulations have also been done with radiation pressure being dominant over gas pressure, and we're beginning to maybe get a handle on whether the stresses care about radiation pressure or gas pressure, and also whether a thermal equilibrium can be established where the heating from MRI turbulence is balanced by cooling. And the final sorts of simulations, which will be of most of interest to the relativists here, I think, are global simulations. Global 3D GR MHD. So fully 3D, fully general relativistic in a Kerr space-time with full MHD, full relativistic MHD. No photons yet, but you know, you've got to walk before you run. And the general structure that arises from these is not like the structure that Hank Sprout drew on magnetocentrifugal driving. You get something that looks like this, where there's the disk. The disk turns out to, you get MHD turbulence in here with these alphas, tau r phi divided by pressure, between 0.01 to 0.1. So that's more or less what we infer from cataclysmic variables, although these are very different systems. The toroidal magnetic field is dominant. And it's obvious why, because this is a Keplerian shear flow, so magnetic fields are constantly being stretched in the toroidal direction. These innermost regions are where the material is basically plunging in nearly radial. This is called the plunging region. Something that's caused a lot of controversy in the community as well is what the nature of magnetohydrodynamic torques might be in this plunging region. And at least in these simulations, which involve fairly pressure-supported, fairly thick disks, there are significant magnetic torques being exerted on the innermost part of the accretion flow by field lines which are stretched out radially in this plunging region. So significant magnetic torques are exerted on the innermost parts of the disk. I'm sorry? Yeah, it's basically the ISCO and N, but the ISCO is sort of ill-defined here when you have, these aren't geodesic motions anymore. But yeah, I'm talking about on the scale of order the ISCO and N side. Then, out here, there's a magnetized corona, often not strongly magnetized, but fairly magnetized. It's hot. There's no cooling in these simulations, so that's not too surprising. And there's a weak outflow in this corona, not very strong. And then here, there's this inner region which is pretty well evacuated by centrifugal forces. And inside that region, you have magnetic fields. These magnetic fields originally, as I understand it, originated from plasma that is plunged into here, stretched the field out radially, but you're still twisting it, and I guess it just comes out in loops and forms poloidal field structures here and poloidal field structures here. They break, these thread the ergosphere and the horizon, and they twist from the spinning of the space-time itself, and you have a pointing flux-dominated jet. And another thing that's been causing controversy over the years is whether you can extract spin energy from the black hole from this pointing flux. And in fact, it seems from the simulations that you can, and this is entirely in agreement with these original predictions by Blanford and Znajak, the relativists who know about this. So these simulations have actually confirmed this fact that magnetic fields can actually torque down the black hole. Yes, the amount of power, that's right. That's right, so that's now considered to be a settled question, I think.
And in other details.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, it's more than that, right? And then in between these two regions, there's actually mass outflow here in a funnel jet. It's not a highly relativistic outflow. You get velocities of order 0.4 to 0.6 C, if I remember correctly. So that's certainly not enough to explain a gamma ray burst jet, which has to have Lorentz factors of 100 to 1,000. And you're nowhere near that here. Now, okay, I'm now going to get tomatoes thrown at me from the people in the audience who are in part of the program. These simulations are fascinating. Okay, all of these simulations are fascinating, but they all have problems and they all need much more work on all three levels. This one in particular, which is the most tantalizing, it gives you the sort of global structure of the flow, leaves lots of questions still unanswered. First of all, it turns out that these jet structures know about the initial conditions that you started off in the simulation. Those initial conditions are generally a black hole with a geometrically thick torus in which you put some magnetic field, which is usually confined to the torus, for example, poloidal field loops. And the poloidal field that you have here knows about the poloidal field that you had in the initial conditions. There's a memory here, okay? And that's a little disturbing, okay? So even though the disk goes turbulent, this structure knows about this poloidal field structure. And I have it on record from Charles that if you break this toroidal this poloidal field up into two loops, that the structure you get here changes. Okay, that's a little worrying because you want your results to be completely independent of these artificial, unstable initial conditions which cannot exist in nature. And so, if you want this, to be the generic structure, you need to know how these two things are connected. And this gets back to the idea of does the MRI, and Steve is not going to throw tomatoes at me, constitute a true magnetohydrodynamic dynamo in which, and it's not known yet whether that's true. The MRI certainly taps into the shear energy of the flow and builds magnetic field. The question is, can the magnetic field develop large-scale ordered field, which is independent of the initial conditions that you started off with? And simulations perhaps have simply not been run long enough. Now, they've been run for long times. I mean, hundreds to maybe the longest is over 1,000 orbital times in the innermost regions, a very long time. But they still retain memory of these initial conditions. And so the devil's advocates in our program, which come from the plasma physics community, say that, you're still observing transients, even though you've been doing thousands of orbital times and watching this turbulence go and go and go. Because you still have that memory, we're not sure whether what you're seeing here is really generic or not. So there's a question as to whether you can build large-scale poloidal field, from the MRI. And that's the assumption on which a lot of the jet models are based. That was the assumption based in Hank Sprout's talk here a month or two ago. Now, it could be that the MRI doesn't do that. The MRI does this. Pointing clocks is a fine way of generating jets, perhaps. It could be that if the MRI doesn't do that and you believe that there's a lot of mass outflow in these jets, that in fact that requires an ordered poloidal field, well, maybe that poloidal field had to be brought in from infinity, dragged in by the disk, and the field was always sufficiently strong that the MRI was suppressed. It simply doesn't exist at all. And that ordered magnetic field, which is whipping around, carrying angular momentum and energy out, is actually what's responsible for the angular momentum extraction of the disk. It's not angular momentum transport through the disk, it's extracting angular momentum from the disk. I am not expressing my own personal opinions here. Those of you who are giving me bad looks. I'm merely trying to convey the range of opinions that exist in the program. I'm going to leave my personal opinions to myself. But that's also been proposed. And, again, which of these things is relevant may also depend on which of these regimes that you're in. Protostellar disks, where the MRI is sort of sluggish to begin with, it's very resistive. And yet we observe very fast, well-collimated jets from YSOs. Maybe this has something to do with field being dragged in, and that's been a point of view expressed in the program. Anyway, I hope this gives a flavor for how the field is transforming itself. We're now building theories that I think are based on real physics rather than just, rather than the fine structure constant, which is real physics, but not the right physics. And I encourage you to attend some of our talks if you want to learn more about how things are going in this field. Tuesdays and Thursdays, here. You mean theoretically or observationally? You can't. I mean, these initial conditions are intrinsically unstable. The MRI is a linear instability. So your initial condition is necessarily a condition that cannot exist in nature. I'm sorry? Unless you had high fields, that's true. So you could simulate highly magnetized flows, and people have done such simulations. And they do, they get for a short amount of time a transient magnetocentrifugal wind that comes off of these things. But so far, such simulations have not been done. I mean, here, Shoji Matsumoto here has done such simulations. And whether that accretion flow and outflow can be sustained for many, many orbital times has not yet been demonstrated. I think that's a fair statement. But yes, people are pursuing such simulation. Yes?
I'd like to repeat the question I asked about a week ago. You were using the language of Keplerian
dynamics.
You mentioned the effective potential of a particle saying it's bouncing back and forth.
Yes.
And your instability
creating
string constant.
Yes.
So what Hamiltonian are you assuming for your particle? Can you write down the Hamiltonian?
I'm not assuming a Hamiltonian at all. I'm assuming a fluid system. I'm assuming a fluid, for the spring.
You worked on an effective potential. Said that there was this elliptic orbit.
Yes.
I forget the proper term.
No, I said there was a circular orbit.
You wrote it D by dr omega.
Yes.
What was that called?
That omega was the Kepler angular velocity of true geodesics of circular orbits in a one over R potential.
Okay, and the variation of that in the elliptic.
Yes, the epicyclic frequency. Oh, I see. That's right.
That comes from a Hamiltonian.
That's absolutely true. That's right. That's
so
right.
You're using Hamiltonian particle. So if you've got a magnetic field, what Hamiltonian are you using?
Okay. I'm not going to write this down in terms of a Hamiltonian. I'm going to say the following, and then we can continue this offline because we have had discussions of this. This is a controversy that's been brewing here. I'm considering here a very geometrically thin disk where I don't care what this disk consists of, magnetic fields, toaster ovens, anything, okay? Because the internal pressure support and the internal magnetic energy density is much, much smaller than the rotational kinetic energy and the gravitational potential energy of this flow, to zeroth order, these are geodesics. These are circular geodesics, okay? And just like the Earth has magnetic fields and people and toaster ovens and all of that, and we can talk about the dynamics of those, of what's going on here in the Earth by going into the rest frame of the Earth, I can move into the rotating frame of this plasma and talk about fluid elements threaded together by magnetic fields or springs or whatever. But this whole thing is sitting in the background of an effective potential, which is given by the centrifugal and gravitational terms in that rotating frame. And I claim, I think just based on these the relative scales of these energy densities, that is a very good approximation. And I know you disagree with me, and I don't think it's productive to have that discussion here for a long time.
Let me ask a completely related question.
Yeah.
In that right hand drawing, you wrote of V5 development.
Yeah.
Is Ampere's law applicable in this situation?
Is Ampere's law? Yes. There are currents.
Physics are okay. I sometimes wonder.
There's even displacement current here because this is a fully relativistic simulation.
Then there's a polar current. Could you draw what that polar current looks like?
Oh God.
Especially if you are.
Homer does MHD, doesn't think about
currents. That's right. Currents don't appear in MHD. I'll show you the currents because we have them now. Thanks to these sorts of questions.
It's more common than you didn't mention galactic.
Yes.
But quite a bit of physics could be.
Yeah, that's true, right. Yeah. So even spiral galaxies as a whole, people have thought about the magnetorotational instability acting in the interstellar medium of our galaxy as a whole and how that might give rise to various or how that might be related to various phenomena. It's not clear because the interstellar medium is magnetically dominant. I mean, right, and yeah. But yeah, the people have looked at that. Yes, and some of those people, Eve Ostrecker, for example, will be visiting the program later on. Chris?
Just going to pick up on that. I thought very great the MRI was avoided the dynamical time, and for the galactic disks, the dynamical times are hugely long. So doesn't that mean it can't be that important on the galactic scale?
Yeah, the orbital period of the Sun is, what, 10 to the 8 years? And so we've had a fair number of orbital times out here. Any other questions from a non-astrophysicist, hopefully? No, okay. I'm sorry that it was so opaque.